The final edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for audiences who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
I'm Jeff Chrysler, and I'm not Tony Hendra, and this is the final edition Radio Hour. Happy summer, everyone. Now that the days are getting shorter, the world is getting absurder. In fact, we've sent Tony on a mission to the center of the Earth to determine what in the hell is wrong with people. So you won't hear him in this introduction. Oh, golly gosh, gee, Mr. Willikers. But you'll hear plenty of him in the show as we and our cohorts talk Iraq, guns, gentrification, viral videos, marriage, millennials, lupus, the cost of speech, Gary Busey, and of course, bacon. So sit back, relax, wonder if I really said Gary Busey, and enjoy the final edition Radio Hour.
Lupus. It can ignite inflammation through your entire body, attacking virtually any organ at any time, inflicting indescribable pain and exhaustion. It is chronic and it is incurable. And do you know what causes lupus? That's right. Unions. Motherfucking unions.
A message from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Tonight on the Round Table, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts gets his wish. The High Court has ruled that people can buy words if they have the money. Reasoning that money is free speech and free speech is money, the court said words can now be purchased for exclusive ownership and use. Major corporations and unidentified individuals have gone into a spending frenzy, buying up most of the English language and occasional Yiddish phrase. Let's turn to our roundtable panel. George Lamont, reporter with Mega International, a wholly owned subsidiary of Comcast. What's your take on this, George?
From my point of observation, this is a benign adjustment whose consequence will cause minimal impingement on the circadian roster of common personages.
So you're saying this ruling is harmless?
Unobjectionable, inoffensive, innocuous, and non-toxic.
Interesting. Let's hear from another panelist, Terry Williams of Pacifica Radio, a low-funded outlet of public radio. If rich people can start buying words, could this cause problems?
Well, it's like... It can get really with the thing. It's you know, when you put a thing like that thing, it can cause things, and things can become really thing-like.
George Lamont, a rebuttal.
Comcast now owns the word thing.
What?
We also own all curse words.
Oh!
Over to Mark Davis at Peeper.com. Mark, your company has been unable to license prepositions. Has this been a hindrance?
Well, it does present us difficulties. We don't want to complain because we might lose the ability to use verbs.
George Lamont, again, reporter with Mega International, a wholly owned subsidiary of Comcast. Will this affect the debate on net neutrality?
I believe the deliberation on net neutrality will play out honorably, with equitable diligence for all sentiments.
Terry Williams of Pacifica Radio, your response? Well, that's your perspective. We're out of time tonight, so come back tomorrow when we'll give all sides a fair hearing on... The Round Table.
Hello, I'm George Biagioni. Welcome to the Second Amendment, the show which examines the gun debate as it shifts from national legislation to social media and fast food restaurants. My guests are Ms. Betty Ryan, former Mayor Bloomberg, and a scary person whose name I haven't yet been given. Hello.
Hello.
Good to be here.
Hi.
Betty Ryan is the leader of a gun control group. What is the name of your group?
Moms demand a sane and reasonable approach to guns, and by sane and reasonable, we don't mean taking guns or regulating guns or blaming guns or pointing at guns or emphasizing guns or talking, thinking, or even wondering about guns.
So, at the MDASARATGABSARWDMTGORGOBLGOPAGOEGOTTOEWAG, what do you mean by sane and reasonable?
We've tried to remove controlling guns from the gun control debate.
And the reason for that is?
I don't know. It was his idea. He puts up the money.
Former Mayor Bloomberg.
Now that I'm no longer the emperor, now that I'm no longer the mayor of New York, I'm looking for something else to water down to suburban comfort levels with my big business approach.
What have you done exactly?
We got Chipotle to stop letting the open carry people bring their guns to their restaurants.
How does that stop school shootings?
How would my partial large soda ban have decreased obesity? I'm a billionaire, not a visionary.
Why don't you put your vast millions behind banning semi-automatic weapons?
Why did I allow Occupy Wall Street protesters in Zuccotti Park and then tell the cops to pepper spray them? If you want consistency, go get Mayor McCheese.
Could I say something?
Who are you?
I'm a gunman.
What kind of gunman?
Lone gunman, you know. I keep to myself, don't go out much, that kind of thing.
What fuels you more, lone gunman? Video games or mental illness?
They're kind of the same thing, but I'd have to say it's the news.
The news?
Yeah. There's no LGA. There's no Lone Gunman Association, so I get all my info from the news. Maybe if the news stopped publicizing lone gunmen, in addition to taking our guns away in the first place, mass murders might go down.
Interesting.
But what do I know? I'm, you know, out of my fucking mind.
Join me next time on The Second Amendment, when I'll talk to someone from a well-hashtagged militia. Good night.
Final edition asked the man on the street, should America go back to Iraq?
I think we ought to go back in there because I still have a whole garage full of unused Aya toilet paper. What, it's the wrong country? It's the same country to me.
What I want to know is, what about Benghazi?
I think we should return to Iraq, but this time we should go in the back way.
Because nobody will see us coming.
Once you leave a place, then they don't let you back in. Because they know, like, after you left Iraq, then you went someplace and got high.
This is between the Muslims and the other Muslims. I don't know what the difference is. They all wear mustaches.
We must not allow a sand dune gap.
We spent all that money trying to get free elections. We can't even get them here. Folks.
Hey, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I wish my wife would go there. Oh, I hate my wife.
What about Benghazi?
But what about Ben Gazzara?
If history shows anything, it's that people will accept democracy if you just force it on them.
What are you asking me for? All I did was fight in Korea for you sons of bitches. When I came back, there were no parades. Okay, there was a parade, but, you know, it was St. Patrick's.
It's time for another episode of Miles the Millennial, sole and hapless intern at the huge global wellness site, BoomerNet.com. This episode, The Blood of Millennial. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles
and miles. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, Head Boomer.
You're late, Miles.
I'm sorry, my girlfriend, like, literally just broke up with me.
The one called Bree?
The one you're in love with.
Yes.
You're better off, Miles.
Good riddance, we say.
Know why we say that, Miles?
Why?
Who wants a girlfriend named after a cheese?
I do.
Have you noticed we all have IVs in our arms, Miles?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry.
Not very observant of you, Miles.
You're here to observe and learn, Miles.
At Boominet, we all give blood, Miles.
Once a month.
Including you, Miles.
It's mandatory.
But I hate the sight of blood. Ow, that hurts!
Man up, Miles. Just a little pinprick.
Not very public-spirited of you, Miles.
There's a national plasma shortage, Miles.
But don't you need my permission?
Why? We pay you good money.
Well, bitcoins.
Miles, you ingrate.
What's wrong with bitcoins?
I guess they're better than getting paid in pizza.
We pay you well for your services, Miles.
Which includes access to your internal organs.
It does?
It's in your contract, which you signed.
In fact, Miles, intern is short for internal organs.
No, it's not.
Are you aware of the very latest research on aging, Miles?
Why would I be? It doesn't concern me. I mean, but I can see how it concerns you guys.
It turns out, Miles, that the fountain of youth doesn't spout water.
It spouts blood.
When two-year-old mice,
analogous to humans like ourselves in our 50s and 60s,
are injected with the blood of two-month-old mice,
analogous, Miles, to persons of 20 like yourself,
they experience dramatic rejuvenation of vasculature
and neural activity
and muscle tissues.
They run on a treadmill for longer.
They navigate a maze much better.
In short, Miles, old brains and bodies are recharged by young blood.
And that's not a metaphor, Miles.
That's a proven medical fact.
Why are you flipping the switches on our IV machines?
Because, Miles, now we've selflessly given pints of our blood.
For a very good cause.
To alleviate the national plasma shortage.
And save lives.
Our blood needs to be replenished. With your blood, Miles.
You can do that? How can you do that? That must be illegal. You'll suck me dry.
OMG. So I took a selfie. I'm posting it on Flickr.
Awesome, dude. Epic. Crazy. YOLO.
Hey, bro. You looking chill.
Guys, everything's spinning around. Can't see, can't catch my breath. Help.
Yo, Miles, that's so random. You eat a pink berry, dude? Just saying. YOLO! YOLO!
I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles.
We'll be right back after this with the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour, a more perfect onion.
Speaker Boehner, Representative Bachman, I, Karl Rove, have asked you here today because Republicans have an image problem. We're seen as reactionary bigots, and it's costing us elections. Now, these gays are getting married whether we like it or not. Can we get on that train without alienating our conservative base?
Maybe we could compromise, Mr. Rove. Gays can marry, but a black guy can't marry a white guy. Or would that get us banned from the NBA?
You know who's sort of white, but not really? Jews. Maybe black guys could marry them instead of real white people.
Yeah, and let's give them Greeks, too. Greeks are also sort of murky off-white. Plus, they worship the wrong kind of Jesus. It's a whole different thing. Much hairier and sweatier. It's very unpleasant.
So, blacks can marry them without angering conservatives or regular Jesus. Everyone wins!
But Latinos are still upset about our plan to deny health care to anyone whose skin can be described as chestnut or darker. Who can we let their gays marry?
Latinos enjoy low-wage labor. Put them with the Chinese.
Yeah, I don't know. I might like to put the Chinese with the Arabs. Keep an eye on everyone at the same time.
No. We have to be against all Arab marriage, or we look soft on terror.
Oh, okay. How about Latinos, Chinese, and let's throw in those Native Americans with long, straight black hair that kind of look Chinese. Get them in on the action.
Oh, this is fun! Let's make everyone dress up in his native costume like at Disney World.
We truly are the party of yes. Okay, I think we got it. Check this out. Blacks, Jews, and those light-skinned South American Latinos can all marry each other. Blacks can marry any Hmong or any of those weird, pasty Southern European Muslims. We're talking about Albania, Serbia, whatever. Your Chinese get your Latinos and your feathered Indians, while your Southeast Asians get dark Latinos and your dot Indians. A Brewers fan may not marry a Pirates fan without the express written consent of Major League Baseball. However, in the case of football, a Cardinals fan may marry a Rams fan, provided that they're both from St. Louis. Soccer fans, Arabs, men who read for pleasure, and anyone with the last name Cantor may not marry on American soil. An adult man may not, under any circumstances, marry a horse. Horses, however, may marry each other or any other terrestrial hoofed mammals. A regular horse may not marry a Jewish horse. An onanist may not marry a hairdresser. A chocolatier may not marry a masseuse. But a psychic detective may marry a 19th century French-Canadian fur trapper. And finally, straight white men can, of course, marry anybody they want, while white women are, as biblically decreed, restricted only to white men.
Excellent work, boys. We'll be back in the White House in no time.
Now that's enough appeasing these sexual deviants. It's time to have intercourse with these horses.
Yeah! Yes!
High five. High fives all around. Yeah. Great. Give me some skin there.
Wow, that's huge.
Look at the flanks on that one.
North Korean President Kim Jong-un has arrived at the state-run Hydrometeorological Service to warn meteorologists against inaccurate weather forecasts. Let's listen to the president's speech.
People of North Korea, here is my five-day forecast. Partly crazy with a chance of nuclear weapons. Ah, ha ha. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows, but you do need a weatherman to know which way I blow. Ah, ha ha. Our meteorological technology is as out of date as the best-selling memoir by my close personal friend, Dennis Rodman. Ah, ha ha. We must join the rest of the world in the field of weather forecasting because we can't join it in the fields of forced labor and human rights violations. North Korea is beset year-round by natural calamities like drought, flooding, and my inability to run a country, even by the abysmal standards of rogue dictatorships. We need to protect our citizens from disasters, even though the best way to do that would be to send me up, up and away in a beautiful balloon. Ah, ha ha. We will predict the weather, but you will never, ever predict me. That's because it's always raining un. Hallelujah. You'd better go outside and let yourself get absolutely soaking wet. Ah, ha ha.
Interesting People, where we meet a variety of people and say, interesting. I'm Sally Gibson, filling in for Candy Steiner, who was out today talking with Martin Mull about what he had for lunch. Our interesting person today is from the world of social media. As you know, there are millions of things to view and comment on every day on Facebook. One of the contributors to this content is our guest, Ronald Zagar.
Hello.
Interesting. Ronald, what do you do in the world of Facebook?
Sally, I make fake viral videos.
Why?
Well, Sally, there's so many things to look at on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, and I said, darn it, there just isn't enough stuff to distract me from life. So I make viral videos that are totally fake.
What's an example?
Well, you know those videos that have recently been creeping up on Facebook that say, this lady was going shopping. You'll never believe what happens next.
Yes, I always get sucked into those.
Well, those are all me.
All of them?
Yes. You know the one with the guy going cliff diving and ends up fighting a shark? My favorite. Fake as can be. The best part is the non-actor yelling, shark, shark, so half-committed, so not caring. It's beautiful. It's like he's not even trying because he isn't. Isn't it convenient that the diver has a camera on his head and the shark shows up on cue? Shark's a union actor, doing me a favor. 80 gazillion views. Thank you.
But with everyone with cameras capturing real content, why do we need manufactured content?
Because most of those things are pictures of their dessert. And if we have a minute of looking up from our phones, we will actually have to interact with each other personally and not virtually.
Interesting. What's next for Ronald Zagar?
Oh, Sally. More videos of people being fake scared, definitely some fake fights, and anything that will start a Facebook comment war.
Wow, Ronald, thank you for coming by and reminding us of what detached pieces of garbage we are. And more kitten videos, please. Fake or not, we need them.
Only if the kitten is being fake tortured to inspire outrage.
Join us next week on Interesting People, where we will talk to an English teacher who stopped working on his great American novel to compose the ultimate tweet. This is Interesting People, and I wish I wasn't Sally Gibson.
Luck, we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour, a more perfect onion.
Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour. It's time for another talk with Tony. Hey, forget about it. Tony Hendra, our fearless leader, has a good story to tell, and it's a story about creative inspiration and the depths of despair that the creatives can fall into. Those of you out there that consider yourself funny or creative or aspiring to do something special may come away wondering if you have to like vodka and Valium in order to succeed, and also how you wish that your down periods could have such beautiful settings. Nonetheless, it's a great story, and it's from The Moth, which I'm sure you're familiar with. If not, look it up. And now enjoy How Rock and Roll Saved My Life.
It's 1982. I am sitting in a sumptuous beach house in Malibu watching a magnificent Pacific sunset. And this is shaping up as the worst day of my life. I was in Los Angeles for two reasons. First, to promote my latest satirical publication. And secondly, to appear in a low-budget movie, which was the directorial debut of an old friend of mine. I wasn't terribly keen about this, never having been in a movie, and he had some deranged notion about shooting it like a documentary. The satirical publication was much more my speed. It was a time, as you probably remember, when there was a man in the White House who was talking quite blithely and frequently about a winnable nuclear war against the godless Soviets. And some of us in New York had decided this was a satirical opportunity, and we'd put together this parody pamphlet of the kind that would inform people of what they could do in the event of a nuclear Armageddon, and it was put out by an agency called the Futile Preparedness Agency. And it gave you little tips about what you could do in the event of a direct hit by a, 100 megaton bomb on your home. It was called Meet Mr. Bomb. And Mr. Bomb was a very cheery, helpful 1950s hydrogen bomb with a wide smile and good teeth and a firm handshake. Now, Meet Mr. Bomb was quite funny, and Newsweek had said they were going to put it on their cover. So I had, at my own expense, 200,000 copies of this printed up. And I had just heard minutes earlier from my publisher that the largest distributor in the Southwest had read Mr. Bomb, and he had not enjoyed it. He was a Razorback Reaganite. And he had shredded every one of the 100,000 copies I'd shipped to him, refused to pay for them, and since I had no money left to sue him, I was effectively bankrupt. Now, the house I was staying in was to some degree a house of gloom. It belonged to a member of the band. Do you remember that legendary 60s group? I had once believed that the band was the greatest rock and roll group in history, if not the universe. And, of course, they had broken up a few years earlier for the usual egotistical, unnecessary reasons, leaving me bitterly disappointed. And the mood that I was in at that point, this breaking up seemed to me to be symptomatic of the age. Things were breaking up, falling apart. They were coming to an end. Peggy Noonan famously called those years morning in America. To me, they were more like late evening in America. And worse things than that were happening. I mean, a year before that, a deranged fan had shot John Lennon in the street. Not many months before this, a death much closer to home had happened, which was that of John Belushi. And I had given John Belushi his first job, actually, his first starring role, in a show I produced for the National Lampoon called Lemmings. And Lemmings was a full-scale parody of Woodstock, at which all the great rock idols got theirs. And John was the sort of satanic MC of all this and was absolutely brilliant, and Lemmings became a big off-Broadway hit, and John was launched on his stellar career and his equally magnificent drug habit, which had just killed him. My first marriage was in ruins, and I knew that basically it was my fault. And it seemed to me somehow appropriate that I was in California. Because California is the end. I mean, it's the end of America. You can't go any further, right? It's after that, it's 5,000 miles of oceanic night, and then you get to China, and it all starts over again. And it was also appropriate that somehow this magnificent sunset was sliding gradually underneath the horizon into Stygian darkness. And for the first time in my life, I just wondered, what the hell was the point in going on? Now, whoever owned this house, Robbie Robertson or Richard Manuel, whoever it was, was kind enough to have left a quart of vodka in it. And I also had with me my very first prescription for Valium. I'd always hated downers, and I'd never taken them, but I'd been sleeping badly, and my doctor said this was the answer. So these two things taken together seemed to me to present a perfect opportunity. So I laid out 10 Valium. I figured that's how many it would take. I took a big, big slug of vodka and took my first Valium ever, and then took another slug of vodka. Nothing much seemed to happen. So I took two more Valium and a really big hit of vodka this time. Still nothing. Clearly this wasn't going to work. I would have to take the remaining 7 Valium and get it over with. And so I took a really big hit of vodka to prepare myself for this step, and I picked up the Valium and I looked at them in my hand for a long time. And I fell asleep. And about 14 hours later, I woke, and I was still just as suicidal, but now I had a massive hangover too. And I remember through the fog that I was supposed to be on a movie set, to be precise, about 4 hours earlier. And it was the last thing in the world I wanted to do, was be in a movie set, and especially a movie about rock and roll, which at this point I hated. And it didn't have a script, this movie. It had to be totally improvised, and I'd never improvised in my life either. But I was a professional, so I jumped in my car and sped across the Malibu Hills and to the location, and they rushed me into hair and wardrobe and so forth and so on, and rushed me to the set, and there were the three stars of the movie, looking absolutely hilarious in their fright wigs. And the set was actually a limo, and I was placed in the limo with them, and somebody yelled, "Action," and we were underway. And they were brilliant. None of them was British, but they all had perfect British accents. And they were being incredibly funny in character, intimidatingly funny. And I knew that very soon, one of them would turn to me and say something, and I would have to answer. Now, I'd done a little homework. I'd read up on improvisation, and I'd talked to all my friends who'd been in improv groups, and the consensus seemed to be that there was one basic rule you had to follow. Listen. You can't bring anything preconceived to improvisation. You must just listen, not just to what people are saying, the other people are saying, but to what their faces are saying, what their bodies and their movements are saying. And if you do that, just simply answer what you hear. It will work. And now the moment came. The character called David was turning to me, and he was saying something to me. And I could see in his face that his character thought my character was pretty sleazy. That this character, whose name was Ian, lied a lot. And out of my mouth came this voice that wasn't really mine. It was sort of evasive and sort of slimily ingratiating. And it had that kind of nasal whine, you know, that was beginning to creep into everyday English. And it worked. It was amazing. I mean, the scene was enabled to continue being funny. I mean, I wasn't funny, but I helped them be funny. And my friend, the director, was very happy with the scene, so we did another take of it, and he was even happy with that. And then we did another scene, and pretty soon the day was over, and I had completely forgotten all thoughts of offing myself. But more importantly, something quite wonderful was happening, which was these stars and the extended cast, and myself too, we were all in some way on the same emotional page. We had all sort of arrived at this deep disillusion and disappointment with this wonderful music that when we were younger we had such high hopes for, that we actually thought some of us would change things, would bring peace and rationality into life, would end racism and war, you remember? And it had betrayed us, and it had been betrayed for us, and it had been a source of failures and disappointments and vulgarity and stupidity and absurdity and pretension and so on. And this whole cast was just coming into that and devising and finding all these wonderful ways in which venality and cynicism and so forth had poisoned this whole area of the art world. It wasn't the big sort of comedic set pieces that I loved. It was the little tiny ones where we would find out new dimensions of this. I'll just give you a quick example. This is actually the favorite scene, at least one of the favorite scenes that I'm in. It's sort of in the middle somewhere. It's about Nigel, who's the lead guitarist, being backstage before a concert, and a large amount of food has been delivered to Nigel, and he's not at all happy with it. And specifically there's some very small slices of bread which have been delivered with this, and Nigel just doesn't understand. I don't see how the bits of meat, how they're too small. The bread's too small for the meat. Look, you see, it won't work. I want big meat. I want big bread. Okay, and it is Ian's job, my character's job, to talk this moron down, you know. So that he can go out on stage and play the loudest music in the world to brain dead teenagers, and they keep buying tickets. That's his job, and Ian does it in this kind of mothering, like he's like a kind aunt, you know, and yet at the same time it's incredibly cynical, incredibly manipulative, and so on. So anyway, that sort of body of work came together throughout this. It was just a wonderful, wonderful shoot, and I would actually venture to say that. That Spinal Tap actually isn't a mockumentary. Because of this wonderful cinematographer we had, Peter Smokler, it was actually a documentary record of a really fascinating collective comedic experiment that took place at a certain point in time and couldn't have been at any other point in time. And that was a success. And I think that's why it sort of works. That's where it gets its edge and authenticity. And I have one little epitaph to this. I haven't the foggiest idea what it means, but I'm going to throw it in anyway. This was about 5 years later, and Spinal Tap was sort of had been out for about 3 years and was sort of on its way to becoming the minor classic that it became. And I got into a cab in New York, and my driver was a quintessential acid casualty. he had one of those beribboned kind of ponytails down to his ass crack, you know. And and he peered in the rearview mirror and he said, "Hey, man, weren't you in Spinal Tap?" And I said, yeah, I played the manager. Yeah, he said. And he said, oh, man, I really dig their music. It's so far out. He said, you know, man, I was into Tap before they made that movie.
We'll be right back after this with the Final Edition Radio Hour. Welcome back to the conclusion of the Final Edition Radio Hour, A More Perfect Onion. It looks like we might make it after all.
I'm Gary Busey. If you're like me, you like holding things in your hand. Amazon made something just for me. Whoa! 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 And I'm not talking about delivery drones that have less business being in the air than I do being on a motorcycle. I'm talking about new Kindle hard copy editions. Kindle hard copy editions are print versions of Kindle books you ordinarily download. They've got these new things called pages that are bigger and whiter than my teeth. Yeah! Now, reading the novelization of the Buddy Holly story is as easy as snorting coke off my dog. Ruff! Ruff! Well, hell, little things I said. Grab me, make me wanna leave rehab. Read on, it's a crazy feeling. It's more fun than drug dealing. When Basil says it's true, baby, read. Ha 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 ha.
Welcome to It's in the Constitution, where experts tell us things you never knew were guaranteed by the Founding Fathers. My guests are Reverend Scott Maddox from the First Evangelical Church of Tax-Exempt Activists.
Hi.
Leon Coons from the Santa Cruz Atheist Vegan Collective.
Thanks for having me.
And Mark Lakewood, a man from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, who's mad at his girlfriend.
Great to be here.
We'll start with Reverend Maddox. What have you found for us this week in the Constitution?
Well, as long expected, it turns out Christianity is America's official religion.
But the First Amendment says we don't have an official religion.
No, but the dollar says, in God we trust, which is Christianity.
Well...
And everything on our money is in the Constitution, including numbers and Lincoln's picture.
You also say the section giving Congress the power to provide the common defense has a no-homo clause.
Actually, I'm finding that everywhere. For instance, the president shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate. No homo.
By the way, I forget, does the Constitution also recommend tax breaks for the richest 1%?
No, that's in the Bible.
Oh, right. Now, Leon, what have you and the goddess worshippers found for us?
Well, as you know, courts often debate how much power goes to the federal government and how much goes to the states.
And you've worked that out?
Yes. It turns out the Constitution vests power with the federal government on every single issue, except gay marriage and medical pot.
I see.
James Madison also said health insurance has to pay for condoms.
Okay. And finally, Mark, what did you find?
Well, according to the Constitution, if a guy wants to go to a party and his girlfriend does not want to go to that party, they have to go if the guy already went with her to some improvised movement theater thing.
The Constitution specifically mentions improvised movement theater?
Yes, and Nordstrom's.
We have a call. Hello, you're on the air with It's in the Constitution.
Hi, this is Lana. Tell Mark I found something in the Constitution, too. If a guy wants to go to a party to play video games and forget what time it is, and his girlfriend has to get up early, then Congress shall allow an exception to the improvised movement theater provision.
No homo.
Also, you're late for dinner.
I am not late.
Well, that's it for us here on It's in the Constitution. Be with us next week when we find out we're supposed to be able to smoke in airplanes.
14th Amendment guarantees that you not be a bitch at least like once a week.
The 15th Amendment says get your ass home now or you're not getting laid for 2 weeks.
Well, now you're just making stuff up. Jerry Lewis is...
Next, please.
The Nutty Abortionist.
Hey, lady! This will be a very, safe procedure, Miss Purdy. We'll simply use the mifepristone in combination with the prostaglandin.
With Stella Stevens as the patient.
I feel so ambivalent about this. Will it hurt?
It's a very safe procedure, Miss Purdy. Just lie back, open your legs, and go! Bathing lady! Oh, no!
The Nutty Abortionist. You'll laugh until you pop. Good morning and welcome to California Sunday. I'm your host, Gary Middleton. As many of you know, last Monday, during a celebration of the L.A. Kings Stanley Cup victory, Mayor Eric Garcetti used the F-word on live television. In case you missed it, we're going to play that clip now.
But there are two rules in politics. They say never, ever be pictured with a drink in your hand and never swear. But this is a big fucking day. Way to go, guys.
Okay. Here in the studio, we're happy to have the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, joining us this morning. Thank you, Mayor Garcetti, for being on our show.
Well, thank you for having me, Gary.
Mr. Mayor, do you have any regrets that you used profanity during a major public event on live television?
Not at all, Gary. Yes, I'm the mayor, but I'm also an LA Kings fan, and I got caught up in the excitement just like any other fan would. And the audience didn't seem to mind.
No, as a matter of fact, just the opposite. They seemed to approve of it. The ovation that followed was tremendous.
Yeah, it was pretty cool, wasn't it?
Still, Mr. Mayor, doesn't it seem inappropriate for someone of your political stature to use language more suited to a bar or a locker room?
Gary, it's hockey. I mean, look at these guys. Half of them don't even have their front teeth. But setting all of that aside for a second, this is a great moment for Los Angeles, and I was just saying what everybody was thinking. I know people tend to think I'm kind of a dull, white bread kind of guy. Well, does a dull, white bread kind of guy say what I said? I don't think so.
But Mayor Garcetti, doesn't this lower the bar for what should be considered shocking behavior on the part of elected officials? Isn't this a slippery slope?
Absolutely not. I just got excited, I said what I felt, and I got a huge ovation. Which I really enjoyed. Quite a bit, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm still coming down off that high.
See, that's kind of what I'm worried about. The next day, you spoke at a meeting of the California Police Chiefs Association.
That's right.
Let's play that clip.
I know the mayor is not supposed to say this, but you guys are a totally awesome bunch of fucking cops.
Mr. Mayor, once again, I wonder, was it necessary?
Gary, these are police officers. Believe me, they've heard worse.
Maybe so, Your Honor, but later in the day, you addressed the Sierra Club. Let's play that one.
And in conclusion, anybody who still denies that climate change is real is a motherfucking piece of shit. Yeah, that time it just didn't work at all.
Your Honor, that's what I'm saying.
Obviously, they were not hockey fans.
No, they were not. What I really don't get is, yesterday you were speaking to a group of 8-year-olds at a summer camp. Can we play that clip now?
Okay, okay. Gary, you've made your point. I don't see what good that could do, and I've already apologized to the children and their parents. That was about the filthiest joke I've ever told in my life.
Yeah, my God, what were you thinking? Anyway, thank you, Mayor Garcetti, for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Gary. I had a fucking blast.
Hello, my little polo ponies. My first guest is Dave Chappelle. He's finally talking about why he turned down $50 million and walked away from his show. I'm walking away from my show, too. Right, Robot Skeleton?
I wouldn't offer you $50 for a bleeding lube job, you arsehole.
Dave Chappelle, my quibbling little non-quintillionaire. What do you have to say for yourself?
I'll put it this way. Okay, I'm gonna do this song. It'll tell you why I gave up the 50 million. Remember, 50 million is only 40 million more than 10 million. Anyway, here it goes. Here comes the verse. As a comedian on stage, I kill. But I don't want your 50 mil. 50 million is not what I want. It's not what I want. No. It's not what I want. 50 million to me is a tumor. Why don't you give it to Amy Schumer? 50 million. It's not what I want. It's not what I want. No. It's not what I want. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to sing this song. I don't care how much money it costs. What? It costs how much? All right. I'll keep going. I don't want to do it, but I'll do it anyway. Here comes the next verse. I know a lot of people are broke, but I don't like the way that guy laughed at my joke. 50 million. It's not what I want. It's not what I want. No. It's not what I want. Rejecting money for me is the new norm. Sometimes I stand on stage and I don't perform. I don't like the way the engineer is working that soundboard. I don't like the way the producer is overseeing this project. I don't even like the way I'm singing this song. That's it. I'm out of here. This time I'm going to Sweden. Maybe Iceland. Maybe Antarctica. Maybe the Cape Verde Islands. Honduras. France. Samoa, Japan, South Korea, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Narnia, Middle Earth, Oz.
The Final Edition Radio Hour is performed at one time or another by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dye, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Kevin Janis, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, Rachel Rauch, Steve Rosenfield, Anne Tuchel, and Darby Worley. The Final Edition Radio Hour is written, at one time or another, by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Jeff Chrysler, David Eskridge, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, and Steve Rosenfield. The Final Edition Radio Hour is produced by Tony Hendra and Jeff Chrysler. West Coast producer Barry Lank. The Final Edition Radio Hour is edited and audio produced by Greg Russ and Andrew Hammond. This episode's audio engineer was Eric West. The Final Edition Radio Hour is the property of the Final Edition LLC, copyright 2014.